than that. One instant I was plain old Flavia Deluce, and the next instant, click, I was plain old Flavia Deluce, but with a difference. For all the tea in China, I couldn't say what the difference was, but only that a distinct change had taken place. And I knew in that instant what I must do. With my heart in my mouth, this wasn't going to be easy. In fact, it was going to be the most difficult moment of my entire life. I made my way to the West Wing. The long line of mourners was still shuffling slowly across the foyer and up the stairs. Most of them averted their eyes as I pardoned my way through the queue and made for Father's study. There could be no half-truths, no excuses, no evasion, no appeals to sympathy, no claims of ignorance, no sweeping of inconvenient facts under the carpet. It was that breathtakingly simple. Really it was. I did not knock. I opened the door and walked in. Father was standing silhouetted at the window, and how old he looked. How very, very old. He had heard me come in, of course, but he did not turn. He might have been a carving in ebony of a dark shadow looking out over the lawn. I went to his side, and without a word, handed him Harriet's will. And without a word, he took it. For a moment, we stared at each other. It was the first time, I think, that I had ever looked my father in the eye. And then I did what I needed to do. I turned and walked out of the room. Of course, I had wanted to tell Father exactly how Harriet's will had come to be in my possession. I had wanted to make a clean breast of it. The whole scheme, my plans for Harriet's resurrection and my surprise presentation of her, newly restored to life, to her grieving husband, to my grieving father. What a scene it would have been! But my well-meaning plan, alas, through no fault of my own, had been thwarted by those interfering killers from the Home Office. Because of them, Harriet would now remain dead forever. Father would realize from the document what I had done. I wouldn't need to say a word. I had no right, of course, to read my mother's will, and I was glad I had not done so. I had realized that while staring at my own reflection in the looking-glass. Her will was not mine to read. I had removed it from its rather unpleasant wallet and put it into Father's hands. For better or for worse, I had done what I had done, and now there was no going back. I had done the right thing, and I would jolly well have to live with it. Chapter 23. Harriet's funeral was now just hours away. There wasn't a moment to lose. I sauntered off across the vista as if I was going for an aimless walk. At the far corner of the ancient overgrown lawn, Tristram Tallis, in blue coveralls and almost invisible in a cloud of blue smoke, was tinkering with the idling engine of Blythe Spirit. He waved a spanner in the air.
"If you've come for another hop, I'm afraid you're out of luck," he said as I reached his side. "And he opened the bottomless pit," announced a loud, dramatic, and rather familiar voice. "And there arose a smoke out of the pit, as the smoke of a great furnace." Adam Sowerby popped round from the other side of the aircraft. I hadn't noticed he was there. "And the sun and the air were darkened by reason of the smoke of the pit." The author of the Book of Revelation, whoever he might have been, was doubtless thinking of recalcitrant aero carburetors when he wrote those words. Adam was always spouting poetry. It oozed out of him like jam from a squeezed bun. "Spare the child," Tristram said, as if I wasn't there. The whole scene had an air of dreamlike unreality. The three of us standing on a ruined lawn in the blowing smoke of a ticking aero engine, and Adam all the while spewing poetic nonsense that would have made even the author of the Book of Revelation, whoever he might have been, fall gasping to the ground in helpless laughter. Only Tristram seemed remotely real, even though, in his baggy coveralls and with the spanner in his hand. He reminded me of a court jester with a bladder on a stick. Who was he, anyway? Beyond the fact that he had once come to Buckshaw to buy Bly's spirit from Harriet, that he claimed to have fought in the Battle of Britain, and that Mrs. Mullet doted upon him, I knew nothing whatsoever about the man. Was he really who he pretended to be? It had been my experience that strangers were not always truthful about their identity. Some seemed able to shrug it off as easily as a wet raincoat. I was simply dying to ask Adam about his visit in the early hours to Rook's End. But to risk doing so in front of Tristram could well turn out to be a bad mistake. As if he were reading my mind, Adam gave me a sly wink behind the pilot's back. I ignored it. Tristram reached into the cockpit, and the propeller clattered to a standstill.
"Fouled plug," he announced. "Nothing to do with the carburetor. So much for revelation, Sowerby."
Adam shrugged.
"I'm afraid the apocalypse of John is rather slender on the subject of sparking plugs, unless, of course, his lightnings and thunderings and seven lamps of fire burning before the throne foresaw the rotary aero engine. Although, that won't quite do, will it? This old girl has four cylinders, not seven, and besides..."
I gave him such a look. Foolishness in a grown man, no matter how light-hearted, is disgusting. There was more here than met the eye. I was sure of it. Why, on the morning of a funeral, would two house guests be fiddling with an aeroplane on an out-of-the-way lawn and burbling bits of revelation? It didn't make any sense. Was Tristram Tallis the tall man I had glimpsed at the window of my laboratory in the cine film? Or could that man have been the one who was pushed under the train? It might have been neither, and I could hardly ask. One of them was dead, and the other, well, the other, if he was who I suspected he might be, would hardly blurt out the truth to a mere girl, even if she was almost 12 years old. And Adam Sowerby. It all came down to this. What was he doing in Bishop's Lacey, and for whom was he working? Was he here as a private investigator, or as a friend of the family? Until I knew the answers to these questions, I could trust neither of these two men. As usual, I was on my own.
"If you'll excuse me," I said, "I have things to do."
South I walked, towards the ornamental lake, until my direction was hidden by the brick wall of the kitchen garden. Then, slowly, I made my way back towards the east, working round the ornamental lake until I was safely hidden by the trees of the palings. Then, across the little bridge to the gully, and it wasn't long before I was climbing Gouger Hill. If it hadn't been for the steepness of Gouger Hill and the jack-o'-lantern, I'd have brought Gladys. I thought of her sitting alone at home, wondering why I had forsaken her. Although Gladys loved nothing better than whizzing hell for leather down hills, she loathed being shoved up them. It made both of us cranky. With a sigh, I trudged on towards my destination. Set among acres of mouldy grass and ancient beech trees, Rook's End was a damp, subsiding monstrosity, consisting on the outside of countless gables, and on the inside of stale, endless corridors. A mushroom farm for humans, I thought. It was not the first time I had visited the place. I had, on several occasions in the past, found it necessary to consult with Dr. Kissing, and I must admit I was quite looking forward to seeing the old gentleman again. I crunched across the gravel of the now empty forecourt and opened the front door. I thought it quite unlikely that anyone would be at the desk, and I was right. The same silver bell sat beside the same smudged sign that read, "Ring, please." I didn't bother. From somewhere in the distance came the sound of many human voices and the clink of crockery. The air was sour with the smell of food prepared by the bucketful, the chiefest of which was cabbage and its derivative gases. I knew that I would find Dr. Kissing where I always found him, at the far end of the narrow solarium.
The bubbling brown linoleum hissed and popped disgustingly beneath my shoes as I made my way across the vast, empty space. From behind the high back of the familiar wicker bath chair, a silvery cord of cigarette smoke spiraled its way up towards a dark and distant ceiling.
"Hello, Flavia," he said, without turning round.
He put down his Times with a faint rustle of paper. I walked quickly into his field of view and gave him a polite peck on each cheek. His skin was as crisp and dry as must be one of those scrolls which have been found in a cave on the shore of the Dead Sea.
"You've come about your mother," he said.
I remained silent.
"As I knew you would," he added.
Dr. Kissing was not a person to beat about the bush.
Nor should I be, I decided.
"My father was here this morning," I said, "before sunrise." Dr. Kissing gazed at me coolly from amidst the rising cigarette smoke. In his mouse-coloured dressing gown and tasselled velvet smoking cap, he might have been one of those impossibly old Oriental idols sitting placidly in a cloud of incense that I had seen on the jackets of the thrillers at Foyle's. If I was going to enter into the game, I might as well show the full strength of my hand.
"So were Aunt Felicity and Adam Sowerby," I added.
"Yes," he said at last, but pleasantly.
"So they were.
I saw their cars in the forecourt."
"Did you indeed?"
"From Bly's Spirit, Harriet's aeroplane. Her owner took me up for a ride."
Dr. Kissing nodded knowingly as he stubbed out his cigarette and reached for another.
"You heard us?"
"The sound of a gypsy moth engine clattering away like a contented sewing machine in the skies above this sceptred isle is one of the few remaining assurances in our changed world. The time, I believe, was 5 minutes before six, and approximately a quarter hour after sunrise."
"Did nothing escape this aged hive of information?"
"I am very sorry about your mother," he said, suddenly grave, and then, after a moment's thought, "you must be especially brave today."
He looked at me with his old, faded eyes, and I knew that this was the moment when I would have my only chance to do what I was planning to do, to say what I had come to say. Dr. Kissing had ordered me to be brave, and so brave I must be. I took a deep breath.
"You're the gamekeeper, aren't you?"
Maddeningly, even though it was barely lighted, he stubbed his cigarette in the overflowing ashtray and selected another meticulously from the flat tin, not because he was nervous, but because he was in control, totally in control.
"Fetch that chair," he said, pointing to an overstuffed horror in a corner.
I pushed the thing, which grated unnervingly on the rippled linoleum, into a position between Dr. Kissing and the window. I seated myself demurely and waited.
"Let me tell you a story," he began. "Let us pretend that once upon a time there was, somewhere in England, an ancient and ramshackle old rectory in which were brought together, in utmost secrecy, some of the greatest brains that could be found in all the land."
I grinned at the thought of all the rows and rows of brains, each in its own glass jar, lined up neatly on a shelf in some dim pantry.
"Is this a fairy tale?" I asked, "or a true story?"
"The Official Secrets Act, even after all these years, still possesses a remarkably long and powerful arm, and so this must remain a fairy tale.
My sister Daffy says that in one way or another, all fairy tales and myths are based on truth."
"Your sister exhibits the hallmarks of a lady and a scholar," he said, "and I predict that she will prosper. Now then, these brains, as I shall call them, brains with a capital B, for they deserve nothing less, were charged with breaking the codes of a faraway emperor."
"Was the emperor wicked?" I asked.
"Of course he was,
as all emperors in all fairy tales must be. Otherwise there would be no point, would there? The evil emperor, you see, is crucial to democracy.
I didn't see, but I tried to look as if I did.
Let us suppose, also, that for many years our far-flung monitoring stations had been gathering and recording all the coded radio transmissions from all the Emperor's ships in all the oceans of the world, and all his ships of the air, and that there had been some little success in cracking one or two of his codes, but not all of them, of which there were many.
You're talking about Japan, aren't you?
We had listened to a remarkably similar discussion on the BBC Home Service during one of the compulsory wireless nights Father had laid on. Besides, everyone knew that of all the enemies with whom we had recently been at war, Japan was the only one with an emperor. Dr. Kissing ignored me and went on.
The problem was this. No sooner would we break a code than the emperor would change it.
How did the emperor know it had been broken?
Ah, Flavia, I am delighted to see that my hope in you has not been misplaced. How did he know, indeed?
Someone was informing him. A spy?
I was proud of myself.
A spy, Dr. Kissing echoed.
A short, nasty word with long, nasty consequences. He blew a small puff of smoke, followed by an elongated grey-blue trumpet, to illustrate his words.
And what if, he asked, what if this spy were to be one of our own, one of the highest among us, one who had even, so to speak, the ear of our king?
Treason, I said,
probably too loudly.
Treason indeed, but what are we to do about it?
Stop him!
How?
Dr. Kissing had pounced upon me like a cat. The answer to his question seemed obvious, but I found myself not wanting to put it into words.
Well?
Well, kill him, I suppose.
Kill him.
Dr. Kissing repeated my words in a flat, matter-of-fact voice.
Just so. But kill, as you will have observed, like spy and stop, is really just one more of those short but exceedingly troublesome words.
Well, capture him anyway.
Precisely. Let us pretend, however, that this traitor, in this fairy tale of ours, is firmly entrenched in one of the far-off branches of our own Foreign Office. Let us further imagine that he also possesses impeccable credentials. What then?
I thought long and hard before replying.
Bring him home to justice, I said at last.
Father had lectured us on the subject of justice during one of his Wednesday lectures on the various aspects of British government, and I thought I had quite a good grasp of the topic. I was not sure I was happy with my solution, though, but I could not think of a better one. To be perfectly honest, I was becoming a little tired of Dr. Kissing's imaginary story. No, not tired. I was becoming uneasy.
How does it end, this fairy tale?
Dr. Kissing took an eternity to answer. He removed his spectacles, produced a spotlessly white handkerchief from a pocket of his dressing gown, polished both lenses with fanatic intensity, put them on again, and with infuriating deliberation, chose another cigarette from the tin box.
That shall be up to you, Flavia, he said at last.
There was a silence between us, which began comfortably enough, but all too quickly became unbearable. I found myself getting up and walking to the window.
I couldn't believe it. I was behaving like Father.
This whole fairy tale business needed thinking about. From my own chemical experiments, I was used to working with hypotheses, but this one seemed beyond me. There were simply too many variables, too many assumptions, too many meanings veiled in mystery. Outside, beyond the window pane,
the ancient beeches squatted in green splendour. The mad women who had danced among them on my previous visits were nowhere in sight. There were no convenient distractions. I had to face up to reality.
You didn't answer my question, Dr. Kissing. You're the gamekeeper, aren't you?
No, he said, suddenly and sadly, perhaps even a little reluctantly. No. No, I am not.
Then who is?
Much as I love the old gentleman, I was becoming impatient with his diversions. Dr. Kissing, almost unaware he was doing so, covered his lips with his right forefinger and then his left. His voice, when it came, was suddenly old, suddenly tired, and for the first time since I had met him, I feared for his life.
That you must find out for yourself, Flavia, he said,
his voice as faint and far away as if it were no more than an echo of the wind.
That, too, you must find out for yourself.
Chapter 24. Dieter met me just to the east of the ornamental lake. He was wearing what looked like a borrowed black suit, which was very slightly too small for him.
Everybody has been looking for you, he informed me.
Sorry, I told him. I needed to go for a long walk. Who's everybody?
Your father, your Aunt Felicity, Ophelia, and Daphne.
Dieter always insisted on calling my sisters by their proper names.
Mrs. Mallet or so.
I have to admit, that was pretty well everybody, although I was secretly pleased that Dogger hadn't been asking my whereabouts.
How did you know which direction to come looking for me?
Mr. Tallis and Mr. Sowerby told me they had seen you walking off towards the palings.
Mr. Tallis and Mr. Sowerby are a pair of bloody village gossips.
Dieter laughed. With Dieter, I could be myself without fear of being corrected, punished, or ratted upon.
What did you think of Bly Spirit? Tristram took me up for a ride this morning. Aren't you jealous?
A pilot in the Luftwaffe, Dieter had been brought down during the war, not far from Bishop's Lacey, and as a prisoner of war, had been put to work on Ingleby's farm. When the war ended, he had chosen to stay in England, and now, 6 years later, was engaged to be married to my sister Feely. It's a funny old world, when you stop to think about it.
She's a beautiful craft, he admitted. But no, I am not jealous. I have had my time in the air.
How's Feely bearing up?
I asked. I had scarcely given her a moment's thought.
She doesn't eat. She doesn't sleep. She thinks only of the music at your mother's funeral.
Poor you, I said, meaning it as a joke.
I wish you could have a word with her, Flavia. I should take it as a great favour.
Me? Have a word with Feely? What a preposterous idea.
She respects you. She's forever talking about my brilliant little sister.
Ha! I said.
I was not at my most articulate when I was stupefied.
Respect me? I couldn't believe it. Feely would rather eat frogs in clotted cream than listen to anything I might have to say.
Still, I didn't want to miss an opportunity.
I'll see what I can do, I said. I should have thought you'd want to comfort her on your own.
It is not comforting she needs, Dieter said, but a female shoulder. Do you know what I mean?
Well, a female shoulder was a female shoulder. There was no great mystery about that.
I nodded. But it won't be easy,
I couldn't resist adding.
No, Dieter agreed.
I think she feels the loss of your mother more keenly than...
Than Daffy and I do, I cut in. Dieter did not deny it.
She has more memories than you and Daphne, he said. She has more of your mother to mourn.
Dieter had hit the nail on the head. It was one of the things I resented most about my sister. Although, when you stopped to analyze it, the jealousy was entirely on my part, not hers.
Poor Feely, I said.
and left it at that.
She'll be better after we're married, Tita said, when she is able to get away from Buckshaw. There are so many ghosts here.
Ghosts? I'd never thought of it in that way.
Any truly self-respecting ghost would rather die than haunt the halls of Buckshaw.
Which set me to wondering. When the dead die, do they come back to life? Is that what resurrection is all about? The death of the dead?
Although I had failed in my attempt to restore Harriet to the arms of her family, I could hardly be blamed. The men from the Home Office had interrupted my experiment, and I knew that I would never have another chance. Harriet would now be laid to rest, and that would be that.
How sad it was that we should never get to know each other.
It was more than sad. It was a damned shame. We paused at the corner of the red brick wall, which marked the corner of the kitchen garden.
"Cheer up," I said,
realizing even as I spoke the words that I had said a similar thing to Daffy.
"How are the teaching plans coming along?"
More than anything in life, other than perhaps the hand of my sister, Tita wanted to teach English literature to the English. He was a lifelong devotee of the Bronte sisters, and was positively champing at the bit to be able to share his enthusiasm in a proper classroom. He brightened at once.
"Can you keep a secret?" he asked.
I nearly laughed in his face. Of all the billions of people who have ever trod the face of planet Earth, none of them, not a single blessed one, has ever been as much a master of the zipped lip as Flavia de Luce. I crossed my heart and my lips and showed him the two-fingered bunny ear sign.
In blood, I vowed.
It was an oath known to very few.
Your father has put in a word for me at Grayminster. I am to begin my teaching duties there in the autumn.
I threw my arms around him. I couldn't help myself. I had known that Dieter had been away on some mysterious interview during the Easter holidays, but had heard no more about it.
"Yaroo!" I shouted. "That's spiffing! Congratulations, Dieter!"
"Keep it under your hat. Is that how you say it? We didn't want to announce it until we've got through the funeral."
I didn't fail to notice the word "we." I gave him another hug.
"Hello, Mr. Chips," I said. "Fear not, your secret's safe with me."
Dieter shot me one of his gorgeous grins and offered me his arm.
"Shall we go in?" he asked. "I shall inform them that you have been found."
In spite of the lovely weather, there was a coldness inside the house which I could not easily explain. It was as if the world had suddenly entered a new ice age, a change that had caught everybody by surprise and left them, every single one, in a kind of chilly lethargy. In the foyer, the last straggling mourners stared at one another in a kind of anti-shock, as if they had abruptly lost the ability to recognize their neighbors. There was an uneasy hush, broken only by the scuffling of shoes on the black and white marble and the suppressed sobs and sniffling of a woman I had never seen before in my life. I think we all of us were realizing that the time of Harriet's funeral was drawing near. It was going to be a bloody awful afternoon. I found Feely in the drawing room, seated at the piano, her face white and her eyes the red of raw meat. Her fingers were moving over the keys, but no sound was coming from the instrument. It was as if she hadn't the strength to summon music from the thing. I stood for a moment or two at the door, trying to guess by watching her fingers what silent melody she might be playing. The very least I could do was to begin the conversation on a civil note.
"I'm sorry, Feely," I said at last. "I know how difficult this must be for you."
Her head came slowly round, and her swollen eyes settled unsteadily on me.
"Do you?"
she asked, and then, after an immensely long time, she added, "I'm glad." She certainly didn't look glad. In ordinary circumstances, although I never tell her so, My sister Feely is strikingly beautiful. Her hair shines with a golden glow, and her blue eyes sparkle vividly. Her complexion, at least since its volcanic activity settled down, was turning out to be what the cinema magazines called English peaches and cream. But now, with Feely hunched miserably before me at the keyboard, I had a brief glimpse of what she was going to look like when she was an old woman. And it was not a pleasant picture. In fact, it was frightening. Worse, I felt an overwhelming wave of pity. I longed to tell her how desperately I had tried to bring Harriet back from the dead, so that we all of us, she and Father and Daffy and I, and not forgetting Dogger and Mrs. Mullet, of course, should live happily ever after. It was, in a way, like Dr. Kissing's story, half-truth, half-fairy-tale. But which half was which? I no longer knew. Was this nightmare pulling me towards reality or fantasy? "Is there anything I can do?" I asked, fighting the undertow of my tired mind. I realized how little sleep I'd had and how powerfully it was affecting me.
"Yes," Feely said. "There is. Don't do anything this afternoon to embarrass us." "As if I were a tramp at the kitchen door."
I think it was the "us" that hurt the most. Just one more of those little words with long shadows, two plain little letters, U and S, that transformed me from a sister into an outsider.
"Has Aunt Felicity had her talk with you yet?" Her voice suddenly as cold and stiff as whipped egg whites.
"Talk? What talk?" Feely turned back to the keyboard, and her hands crashed down in the most harsh, the most grinding, the most tortured series of chords imaginable. I clapped my hands to my ears and fled the room. I raced along the hall and across the echoing foyer, hang the gaping mourners, up the staircase and into the east wing. I flung open the door of my laboratory, dashed inside, slammed the door behind me, and pressed my back against it. A tall man turned round, and in his raised hand was a test tube which he had been examining. It was Sir Peregrine Darwin.
Chapter 25. "I believe this is cyanide," he said, and not at all pleasantly.
I nodded. I could hardly deny it, particularly to a man whose specialty it was to professionally identify cyanide. "The laboratory belonged to my great-uncle, Tarquin de Luce. Perhaps you've heard of him." I was taking a risk, I knew, but it was at the moment the best I could come up with. Perhaps Sir Peregrine, I thought, had been at Oxford with Uncle Tarquin. But no, he wasn't old enough. But surely he must have heard of my uncle's work. Perhaps he'd even idolized him as a boy. Blood among chemists runs thick. At least I hoped it did. But it was no use. Sir Peregrine didn't rise to the bait. He replaced the cyanide in its rack with a careful precision that I had to admire. This man knew what he was doing.
"Your mother's inner coffin was cut open with a pair of 10-inch tinman snips," he said accusingly.
I tried to look incredulous.
"Yes, you left the tools of your trade behind. We've sent them up to London for analysis and have just received back the report that your fingerprints and your fingerprints alone are all over them. Explain."
"Well, had my fingerprints on file, did they?" I must admit I was flattered. The Hindley Constabulary must have handed them over from one of my earlier investigations. Still, I had to give the man credit. He certainly didn't believe in letting the grass grow under his feet. If he had the ability to whisk a piece of evidence up to London and have it analysed and brought back to Bishop's Lacey within hours, the man was clearly no slouch. Inspector Hewitt would be chartreuse with envy. I could hardly wait to tell him.
"Well?"
He was waiting, and the look on his face could only be described as grim.
"In case you are not aware of it, Mr. Luce, interference with the burial of a dead body is not—"
"I didn't interfere with her," I interrupted, the blood rushing to my face. "I didn't touch her."
"Then what, pray, may I ask, were you doing?"
She was my mother, I said. I'd never seen her face. I wanted to, before she was buried.
I tried to stare him down, but my lower lip was trembling. Sir Peregrine did not look away. Slowly he began to walk towards me, seeming to grow taller with every step, until he was hovering over me like a bird of prey. I found myself shrinking away from him, cringing.
Peregrine!
The voice cut through the air like a thrown knife. I spun round.
Aunt Felicity!
Felicity, said Sir Peregrine.
What are you doing to that child?
I could have cheered, even if she had committed the unforgivable sin.
Well, Peregrine, explain yourself. I was merely doing that which I am required to do by His Majesty's government.
Poppycock, you were trying to intimidate the girl. You ought to be ashamed of yourself.
Felicity.
Sir Peregrine was gaping as if he had been set upon by the Furies, those avenging goddesses of the underworld, with their black robes, bloodshot eyes, and snaky hair, whose happy job it is to punish evildoers.
Come along, Flavia,
Aunt Felicity said, almost dislocating my arm, as she seized me by the elbow and marched me out of the room.
It's time we had a talk.
We were halfway down the staircase before she let go of me.
Quickly, she said, hustling me through the kitchen, holding open the door and urging me through.
Where are we going?
You'll see, she said.
I hate people who say that.
Halfway across the visto, I was still trying to catch up. For an elderly lady, I realized Aunt Felicity was remarkably fit. Bly's spirit was still parked as I had last seen her, but Tristram Tallis was nowhere in sight, nor, for that matter, was Adam Sowerby.
Get in, Aunt Felicity ordered, pointing.
I clambered up onto the wing and dropped into the front cockpit. Aunt Felicity, without further ado, went round the nose of the craft and gave the propeller a couple of remarkably powerful pulls.
Switch on, she shouted.
I looked at the instrument panel and could see only one switch. It was marked Magneto, and I twisted it to the right.
Switch on,
I called back. I had seen this done in the cinema, but had never actually had the opportunity to do it myself. Aunt Felicity gave the prop another sharp spin, and as it had done this morning, it vanished with a roar. Whatever Tristram had done with the faulty sparking plug must have cured the problem. The engine was running with a silky, self-satisfied rumble, popping a bit with joy, as if it could hardly wait to get off the ground and into the air. Now Aunt Felicity was lowering herself into the rear cockpit, and the stick and pedals in front of me began to wigwag of their own accord. The throttle shot forward in its metal quadrant, and we began to move. The visto became a blare. Buckshaw rotated slowly in the near distance, as if it were on a turntable and we were standing still. And then the ground dropped, and for the second time in my life, I was flying. Bly's spirit pitched and bucked as the stick in front of me shook in its socket. Aunt Felicity was trying to get my attention. I twisted my head round and was just able to catch a glimpse of her. She was jabbing a bony finger to indicate the flying helmet, which she must have dredged from the depths of the cockpit, and she was obviously signalling me to do the same. I reached under the seat, and sure enough, there was an identical helmet. I strapped it on. Now the stick was waggling again, and I turned to see Aunt Felicity waving the end of a ribbed rubber tube. She put it to her ear, then to her mouth, and then her ear again. At first, I thought she was merely trying to entertain me, that she was miming some lurid magazine cover, such as Thrilling Tales, in which a pilot is wrestling at 5,000 feet with a boa constrictor, which some nefarious villain has concealed in the cockpit. Until I was made to realize, by the violent and impatient shaking of the stick, that there was a similar tube beside me in the front cockpit, and that Aunt Felicity wanted me to use the thing for speaking and listening. I nodded and held the yellow tube to the ear socket of my helmet. Again the stick shook like a cornstalk in a hurricane. Aunt Felicity was pointing to her ear, and I saw at once what she wanted me to do. There was a socket in the side of my helmet
into which the tube was meant to be inserted. I plugged it in, gave it a twist, and Aunt Felicity's voice was suddenly in my ear.
"Can you hear me?" she asked.
I gave her a thumbs up, which seemed the right thing to do in the circumstances.
"Good," she said. "Now, listen to me. We've precious little time, and what I have to say to you is of the utmost importance. Do you understand?"
I gave her three more thumbs for emphasis as she banked Bly's spirit round towards the west. Beneath our wings, Buckshaw lay spread out in the sun, a dreamy mirage of green lands, a fairy tale kingdom in miniature. From this altitude, you could not see the black line painted in the foyer that divided the house into two camps, nor could you detect the frost that had recently descended upon the house. Or had it been there all along, and I had only recently learned to notice?
"Take a good look, Flavia," Aunt Felicity's metallic voice was saying. "You may never see the likes of it again."
We were suspended in the air, the two of us, perhaps a mile above that special part of England which was ours. Tomorrow, after the funeral, it would probably belong to someone else. Even if Harriet's will untied Father's legal entanglements, there was no money left to go on. Buckshaw had become a crushing burden that could no longer be borne. Like Atlas, forced to put down the world from his shoulders in order to fetch apples from his daughters, the Hesperides, Father would not likely have the heart to take it up again. In the old legends, anyone who willingly took up the earth upon their shoulders was doomed to carry it forever. A curse, it seemed, with no way out.
"All of this belonged to your mother," Aunt Felicity said through the speaking tube, shouting to be heard above the roar of the engine, her voice coming through the tube in machine gun bursts. "She loved it here. Nothing was more precious to her than her home and her family. Harriet went away, only because she had no other choice. It was a matter of life and death. Not your life and death, or mine, but that of England. Do you understand?"
I nodded and looked out at the England that was beneath our wings.
"Your father had already been taken prisoner by the Japanese, but your mother was unaware of that. When she volunteered to go on a mission, which only she could accomplish successfully, she was devastated at having to leave her three children in the care of others."
Aunt Felicity's words brought back barely recalled memories of being dressed and fed by strangers, a failed succession of nannies and governesses, none of whom, I later learned, had been Mary Poppins.
"But your mother knew her duty," Aunt Felicity went on. "She was a Deluce, and the life of England was at stake."
Behind and below us to the southwest, Buckshaw Holt was vanishing in the slight haze that had appeared, and I remembered the words that Mr. Churchill had spoken to my father.
"She was England, damn it," he had said.
"She was more than that, Prime Minister," Father had replied.
Only now was I beginning to realize how much more. Harriet had volunteered for the mission Dr. Kissing had spoken of in his so-called fairy tale, a mission to bring home to justice a traitor who had sold himself out, and England with him, to the Emperor of Japan.
"Under diplomatic immunity, she had made her way to Singapore," Aunt Felicity continued, breaking into my thoughts, "where, unknown to her, your father was already attached to the Far East Combined Bureau. But before she could discover that, he was captured by the Japanese on Christmas Day and thrown with a handful of his staff into Changi Prison."
Aunt Felicity's voice came strangely to my ears, constricted to an insect buzz by the speaking tube. But her words were clear enough. Father had been imprisoned, and Harriet was likely to be.
"At this crucial instant, the Japanese were still playing a double game. On the one hand, they had captured your father, while at the same time, they were trying to demonstrate that they were masters of the world.
They even took your mother on a guided tour of the prison at Changi to show off to her the British officers they had in custody. She was to carry the word back to London, and the War Office would capitulate at once. Such was their thinking, sheer madness.
My mind was as blurred as a spinning propeller. How could this whole chapter of my family's history have taken place without my suspecting? It seemed impossible. Perhaps Dr. Kissing had been right. Perhaps it was a fairy tale.
It was there, in that dreadful compound at Changi, that your parents were thrust suddenly and unexpectedly face to face, your mother being shown the prisoners who had been trotted out for her inspection, your father being taunted with the sight of an English visitor. Neither of them knew the other was in Singapore, but neither batted an eye.
Oh, how it must have torn their hearts, I thought. How killing it must have been to show not a flicker of recognition. To have to pretend that they had never been in love, had never married, and that their three children, the youngest no more than a baby, left behind in England to be brought up by strangers, had never existed. I twisted round in the seat so that I could see Aunt Felicity. Her eyes were enormous, like an owl's behind her goggles, as she gave a nod as if to say, "Yes, it's true, every word of it." My own eyes stung with tears. I didn't want to hear any more. I threw my hands up to cover my ears, but they could not block out Aunt Felicity's words, which came seeping again through the rubber tube. "Flavia, listen. There's more. You must listen to me." I could not ignore the sound of crackling command that had suddenly come into her voice. "The traitor your mother had come to deal with had apparently vanished. The political situation had become far too dangerous to remain in Singapore. She was making her way home, by way of India and Tibet. But she was followed. Someone had betrayed her." My mind went numb. Black thoughts tossed in my mind like the billows of some dark sea. Had Harriet been murdered? I had wondered that before, but set it aside as incredible beyond belief. But was that now the suspicion of the Home Office? Was that why Sir Peregrine Darwin had shown up so unexpectedly on our doorstep? Was the killer still at large? I wanted to curl up like a salted slug and die. Aunt Felicity's voice broke into my agony. "You've heard, no doubt, of MI5 and MI6. I managed a nod. Because she could see only the back of my head, she could not possibly know I was crying. "Well, you need to know that there are MI numbers beyond 19. Indeed, there exists a section with so high a number that not even the Prime Minister is aware of it." Now the tube fell silent. What was she telling me? Far below, the green world circled. On the ground, you were like a bug in a carpet, believing every crumb to be a castle. But from up here, you had a whole new view of things. You could see far more. More, perhaps, than you ever wanted to. I gave a feeble wave to show Aunt Felicity that I was listening and that I had understood her words. Seeing my hand, she went on. "We Deluces have been entrusted, for more than 300 years, with some of the greatest secrets of the realm. Some of us have been on the side of good, while others have not." What was the old woman saying? Was she mad? Was I alone in the air with a person who should be locked away in Colney Hatch? And yet, she was flying Bly's spirit, wasn't she? Again, I remembered asking Father what Buckshaw looked like from the air. Remembered his reply.
"Ask your Aunt Felicity. She's flown."
I had assumed, I suppose, that she had flown with someone else as a passenger. But Father's words had been literally true.
"Did you hear what I said, Flavia?"
Aunt Felicity reduced the throttle, and the sound of Bly's spirit's engine died away to a whisper. Now there was only the howl of the wind around us, as her voice, containing a new urgency, came crackling through the rubber tube.
We must go down now. There's no more time. But before we begin our descent, you must understand. From this day forward, much will be expected of you. Much has already been given to you. In many ways, your training has already begun.
Realization crept slowly into my mind. My laboratory, the almost magical way in which the gases and glassware had never been exhausted. Someone had seen to it.
You must never speak of this to anyone but me, and then only when we are out of doors and absolutely alone.
That day last summer, on the island of the Ornamental Lake.
You must never be deflected by unpleasantness, Aunt Felicity had told me. I want you to remember that. Although it may not be apparent to others, your duty will become as clear to you as if it were a white line painted down the middle of the road. You must follow it, Flavia.
Even when it leads to murder? I had asked.
Even when it leads to murder.
The full impact of her words came crashing upon me now like a breaking wave. My father's sister had been guiding my life for ages, maybe forever. It was only with the greatest effort that I managed to grip the sides of the cockpit and twist round in my seat so I was looking Aunt Felicity directly in the eye, or at least in the goggles. Her face was utterly impassive as she stared directly into mine. Borne up by no more than the rush of the wind, it was as if we were riding the hurricane. Slowly, but with great deliberation, I raised my right hand and gave her a thumbs up that might have made Winston Churchill proud, and Aunt Felicity returned it. An instant later, she poured on full power and we were diving towards the ground. As we glided in over Bishop's Lacey, I could tell by the shadows that it was well past noon, and cars were already being parked on the road on both sides of St. Tancred's. Even before our wheels touched like thistledown on the Visto, Tristram Tallis was striding in the distance towards us. Aunt Felicity cut the ignition, and we both scrambled out onto the wing. I had already torn off my helmet and waited until she had removed her own. For one brief moment, we were out of doors, and we were alone. "Pheasant sandwiches," I blurted suddenly, risking all. My aunt's face was as impassive as if it were cut from cold marble. A stone sphinx, perhaps, transported by magic from Egypt. Tristram Tallis was now halfway to the aircraft. There were just seconds left before he was upon us.
"You're the gamekeeper, aren't you?" I asked.
Aunt Felicity stared at me, her face a mask. I had never been so bold in my life. Had I said too much? Had I gone too far? And then my aged aunt's mouth opened just wide enough to allow one small word to escape.
"Yes," she said.
Chapter 26. Aunt Felicity and I spoke not another word as we entered the house from the kitchen garden. To an observer, it might have appeared as if we were a couple of casual acquaintances returning from an afternoon stroll on the lawns of Buckshaw. Things were beginning to make sense. Pieces were falling into place. Aunt Felicity, I knew, had rather a peculiar and unlikely circle of acquaintances. As far as I could deduce, she seemed to have been some kind of queen bee at the BBC during the war, but had always refused to discuss